some word association. If I say Anna, you say, well, quite probably Wintour. And that's a test of fame, that first name familiarity, instant association from a single word. Anna Wintour, editor-in-chief at Vogue since 1988, a length of tenure that's almost unfashionable, a very public position inhabited by a woman who has remained enigmatic in many ways. Author Amy Odell is a fashion and culture journalist, and she's been on a mission to get behind that enigma, to find out who the woman is behind the manicured bob, the ubiquitous sunglasses. She's the author of Anna, a biography. It peels back the layers of fashion's most influential figure. It's a New York Times bestseller. So, Amy, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Can I start with the sunglasses? Do we know the make, the model?
You know, it's funny because she wears in recent years maybe Chanel sunglasses, but she when she first started wearing the glasses, they were often Ray-Bans. And, you know, the sunglasses are part of what has contributed to her enigmatic persona that she has maintained for 34 years, which not many people have had the opportunity to see beneath. And many people who have known Anna for a long time even still describe her as complicated and have a hard time understanding her. And in writing Anna, the biography, I had the opportunity to interview more than 250 people, many of whom are very close to Anna and have never spoken on the record before, and have the opportunity to describe to readers who this very powerful woman really is.
That thing of withholding, that thing of maintaining mystery, is that calculated from her, or is that just an accident of character?
Some people think that she's calculated, and some people think it's an accident. She's a woman with a lot of duality. She is someone who you could be out with her at a party, you could be laughing and having a sort of friendly encounter with her, and then the next morning at the office, see her, and she'll be very icy to you. And it's as though that interaction from the night before never, ever happened.
I wonder why. I wonder what the thinking is in her mind. I mean, did you, in your work, you say you talked to 250 people and many of them very close. Did you come to an understanding, do you think? Have you got behind the sunglasses?
Yes, I think I have got behind the sunglasses, which are actually prescription. Anna has said in public that the glasses are to hide what she is thinking or feeling. And that may be partly true, but she really wears them because
also so she can see.
Yeah, but that's just kind of an example of how she has just not really been very forthcoming. As many of us know, she's someone who has worked very, very hard to get where she is. She's very focused. She's very ambitious. She tries very hard to stay engaged with youth culture, with culture broadly. She can be cold and she can be icy at the office, but people also described her as someone who absolutely loves her family, adores her grandchildren, has changed their diapers, loves her dogs. Many people have seen a warm side to her that others haven't seen. And so many things about reporting this book surprised me. For instance, that she wants to be known for her philanthropy and not for anything that she's done as a magazine editor.
She's steeped in the practice of media, of course. Her father was an editor himself. What was his impact on her early life?
Charles Winter is Anna's father, and he was the editor-in-chief of the Evening Standard, which was a very influential newspaper in London. And he had that job. He worked at the paper from the end of World War II through the 60s, the swinging 60s in London, when Anna came of age, in which she credits with sparking her passion for fashion. He had a background as a political journalist, and he was known for covering hard news, but also taking culture just as seriously. And it was a very vibrant cultural moment in London, of course. And her parents had dinner parties quite often at their home, and they would invite politicians or well-known journalists from the Evening Standard. And she was exposed from a young age to this intellectual, glamorous milieu.
He cut her off without a penny, though, didn't he, in his will?
It is true that her father did not leave her anything in his will. However, at that point, this would have been the late 90s, I believe.
She was doing okay.
And Anna was making surely a lot of money. And she also, as I report in the book, she had a number of privileges that really enabled her to succeed in media, including benefiting from a trust fund that her mother's father set up for his grandchildren. Anna received payments out of that trust from the time she was really starting her career, and she continued receiving those payments for many years. It wasn't, I want to be clear, it wasn't so much money that she would never have to work, but it was enough money that she could afford to make mistakes or take jobs that didn't pay that well.
That's a great gift. You mentioned that 60s London, the miniskirts and bobbed hair. I mean, it was suddenly a style that perhaps suited young Anna, who was a bit of a tomboy.
Yes, as a child, friends of hers from the time said she was a tomboy. She was not at all interested in her clothes. She would go to grade school with her uniform askew, with her knees scraped up.
And sunglasses, of course.
No sunglasses. She was primarily interested in sports and physical activity. And that was how she related to her classmates. But she's also someone who never liked school. She's a very smart woman. She's always read a lot. She reads a lot today. But she never liked school.
Maybe one of those kids for whom school was a bit slow. That could have been the...
Yes, knowing as much as I know about her now, I can kind of understand, you know, if you're not someone who wants to spend more than 15 minutes in a work meeting, you might have a hard time sitting through hours and hours of lectures every day.
Destined for journalism, and she starts out at House and Garden, which didn't go well.
No, so Anna had a number of jobs as a fashion editor before she became an editor-in-chief. Her first editor-in-chief job was in London running British Vogue. And then she came back to New York, where she really, really wanted to be. And Condé Nast gave her House and Garden to run. And this is one of the things that many people see as a failure on her resume, because she changed the magazine so drastically. She introduced fashion. She had models in the Bagatelle Gardens of Paris wearing dresses and highlighting fashion in a magazine in which people had never really appeared before. And I realize that that sounds kind of weird today, because if you think of a interior magazine today, you expect to see personalities in those images. You expect to see celebrities in their homes and things like that. But this was not typical for the time at all. So she introduces this approach. She changes the name of the magazine to HG. Subscribers and readers get very upset. They start calling Condé Nast to cancel their subscriptions. Advertisers pull out. With HG sort of taking a nosedive, it is in this moment that she is tapped to become the editor-in-chief of American Vogue in the summer of 1988.
Going back a little bit before that, New York Magazine was, I think, an interesting interlude for her, in particular the way that she sort of approached office culture.
Absolutely. Anna had a few stumbles before she got to New York Magazine. She was fired from Harper's Bazaar in New York. She went on to a magazine called Viva, which folded, and then another startup called Savvy, where she barely earned any money. And then from there, she went to New York Magazine, which was a staff job. It was a place where journalists really wanted to work. They were known for publishing really great, journalistically robust stories. Yet she was coming in to do fashion. The stuff that she was used to doing, these beautiful fashion layouts, that wasn't necessarily germane to much of the rest of the magazine. So she was kind of coming in as this unusual presence in the office. You know, it was a newsroom, really, with like old newspapers scattered everywhere. And it wasn't like a fashion magazine. It wasn't like there were beautiful racks of clothing everywhere. And she came in and she set up, the first thing she did was set up her workspace. And she had a white desk and just sort of like erected a white background around her. And brought in her own chair. And this had never been done before. This was so unusual. And her colleagues at the time were thinking, who is this extremely glamorous, well-dressed, beautiful woman wearing sunglasses coming in and bringing her own perfectly white workspace? It was unusual,
to say the least. But there we are. I mean, I'm just trying to get my head around how that would feel at a workplace and that little island of style over there, what I would make of that. She becomes such an extraordinarily influential and powerful person. I mean, she determines so much of the world's sense of style. What a remarkable achievement in a career.
Her success is unmatched in magazines, in fashion, but even beyond that, I would argue, if you think of business leaders generally, so Anna Wintour, as we've said, has been at Vogue as editor-in-chief for 34 years. Jeff Bezos left Amazon after 27 years. I think the average CEO tenure these days is five or less. So her longevity is really unusual. It is unmatched. And some people I spoke with feel like her cultural innovation in that time is on par with Steve Jobs.
It's all very well being something for a long time and to acquire power, but the keeping of that authority, that takes work, that takes an assiduous sort of gift in networking, I suppose.
Absolutely. Anna is someone who navigates corporate politics very, very well. Condé Nast, the parent company of Vogue, is a huge corporation. She is able to do two things very well. One, talk to the creatives on her team and also talk to the business leaders at Condé Nast. And that's really the challenge of being an editor-in-chief, is managing the creative side and the business side and bringing them together. And she does the same thing in the fashion world. She can talk to designers and she can also meet with the CEOs of labels and engage with both of them.
And yet, I mean, as much as she's fearsome and known for her strength of opinion, to survive that long in a cultural world which transforms itself decade on decade, that must mean you also have a very open mind as well.
In some ways, yes. I think that she has learned to evolve her approach just enough over time to keep Vogue relevant without alienating people. One example of this is when she first put Madonna on the cover of Vogue in May of 1989. It sounds today quite obvious that Madonna would be on the cover of Vogue, but in 1989, Madonna was a pretty controversial public figure. Anna put her on the cover anyway, knowing that, and knowing that it would drive conversation around Vogue and sort of poke a hole in the public's idea of what Vogue could be. She did this again when she put Ivana Trump on the cover in 1990. She, in fact, walked into the office of one editor I spoke to and said, "Do you think it's too tacky to put Ivana Trump on the cover?" He said that she should do it, and she did, and the issue sold well. So she knows how to make moves like that that keep the magazine feeling fresh, but that aren't too out there so that they alienate people, which was the mistake that she made at HG.
Yeah, tricky balance. But has Vogue, do you think, though, managed to surf the demand for diversity, surf the demand for, you know, total representation of culture that's so much a part of the modern world?
The turning point for Vogue and Anna embracing diversity was really the summer of 2020. Before that, all you really have to do is look at the covers of Vogue under Anna's tenure to see where diversity ranked as a priority for her.
Mm. Will she stay too long, do you think?
It's remarkable, completely remarkable, that she has retained the executive perks of her position, which other editors-in-chief have lost. And I talk about these in the book. For instance, being able to get her hair and makeup professionally done at her home and then have a chauffeur drive her to work
every day
at her office. The perks that were so common in the golden era of magazines, the business really doesn't spend money on for many editors anymore, but Anna still retains this extraordinary lifestyle.
And that, no doubt, will go with her. There's no way that anybody incoming would be able to gather that around them in this world.
Yes, I would be surprised if the number of perks that she's received were passed on to the next person. That said, I do believe that there will be a transition, and I think that the success of that transition is going to hinge on partly on the fashion industry embracing the next editor-in-chief of Vogue as its leader. I believe that when Anna leaves the position and a new person takes the job, that will happen again.
Extraordinary vacuum. My mind is going back to the Queen Elizabeth comparison. That it's, you know, it's a similar position for somebody in a long period with tremendous power that leaves such a vacuum in their passing.
Yeah, a lot of people compared Anna to royalty, not only because of her longevity and her presence in that role not really being questioned at all, but also just kind of the dynamic in the Vogue office for so many years. People described it as almost like a royal court where Anna has key people who are very close to her. She communicates primarily with them and she has almost nothing to do with lower ranking staffers. And one person described hearing around the office how when Vogue was trying to fill an assistant position, the rumor was it was going to be filled with a princess or a socialite. Well,
there is a prospect to look forward to. Amy, congrats on the book. Do you know how it's been received by its hero?
I don't know how Anna feels about the final product. I am just as curious as anybody else.
I'm sure you are. Maybe one day that secret will be revealed. Amy O'Dell, she's a fashion and culture journalist. And the book in question is Anna, the Biography. And you'll find that in shops and libraries. And this is Blueprint on Radio National.